"Inform the Benthos that we no longer have propulsion," Benedict ordered. "Once they've aligned the docking bay over us, we'll drop ballast and drive straight up into the docking clamps. Make sure the docking arms are stretched to full capacity. We'll need all the leeway we can get for this maneuver, and we only get one shot at it."
"Understood, sir."
A few moments later, Terry felt the Prometheus ascend vertically from the seafloor. She whispered a prayer of thanks as the hydraulic docking arms of the Benthos guided the sub back into the safety of its bay. Tigers of the Deep. Mariana Trench.
"There's nothing left to repair," Captain Hobbs said,
staring into the abyss from the observation deck.
"Whatever attacked the Prometheus literally tore the screw right off the drive shaft."
Benedict stroked his goatee, deep in thought.
"Contact the Goliath. Inform them I want to complete the sub and crew exchanges 12 hours ahead of schedule. I expect the Epimetheus to be in the water and descending within the hour. Captain Warren, assemble your crew aboard the Prometheus. Your shift is over. Lacking propulsion, you'll have to allow your sub to drift free from the docking bay. Wait for the Benthos to clear, then drop your ballast and free-float topside for repairs."
"Aye, sir," Captain Warren said. "What about the girl she's expecting to ascend?"
"For now, the girl will remain aboard the Benthos."
"Benedict, what harm would it do to let her go?" Captain Hopp asked.
"She knows nothing."
Benedict's eyes seemed to sizzle.
"Are you questioning me again, Captain Hopp?"
"I only..."
Benedict's piercing gaze cut off the man's objection.
"No, sir."
"Sir, what about these creatures?" Captain Warren asked.
"Where's our paleobiologist?"
"William should be in his lab," Hopp said quietly.
"That's where I'll be. Gentlemen, carry out your orders. Oh, and Captain Hopp, have Sergei join me in the lab."
CIA agent Heath Williams slipped the microcassette into a hidden compartment in his duffel bag, then finished packing his belongings.
"Going somewhere, Professor?"
Benedict asked, entering the lab.
"Mr. Singer, you startled me. Yes, I heard the Prometheus was surfacing early. As I told you when you hired me, I have to be back at Scripps Institute this week for a series I'm hosting on the distribution and diversity of Cretaceous kelenoids, but I'll be returning the following week. The section of fossilized skeleton you recovered, it's absolutely incredible."
"Is that so?"
"Yes, I left you a complete report detailing the species."
"I detest reading reports, Professor. I prefer to hear verbal details directly from the source. So if you don't mind..."
Of course not, if I have time.
"When will the Prometheus be leaving?"
"Not until you and I have completed our discussion, so take your time."
Heath led him to the back room where the immense grayish-black object lay beneath surgical lights. 4 steel tables had been positioned together to support the relic, which was over 10 feet long and 8 feet wide, rising upward of 5 feet at its highest point.
"What we're looking at," Heath said, "is a cross-section of a skull from an extinct order of marine reptiles known as Plesiosaurus. There were 2 major subspecies of plesiosaur, which differed in the lengths of their necks and in their feeding habits. This particular specimen is a member of the superfamily Pliosauroidea, a short-necked, carnivorous breed considered by paleobiologists to have once been the tigers of the Mesozoic seas. As you can see, these monsters possessed extremely large heads with short necks, which streamlined their bodies for swimming. The jaw muscles were quite strong, the teeth were particularly hideous. Needle-like cones, slightly curved and razor-sharp, protruding out of the jaw like those of our modern-day crocodile. Here, take a look for yourself."
Heath pointed to the narrow end of the skull.
"It's a little difficult to see because the jaws themselves have been so severely crushed by the predator that killed it, but if you look here, you can still see fragments of 4-inch teeth."
"And you call this a pliosaur?"
Benedict asked, examining the jaw.
"Actually, I've identified this particular animal as a Kronosaurus, the largest of the known pliosaurs. The species dates back to the early Cretaceous, more than 100 million years ago. Until Carcharodon Megalodon came along, these monsters were the true lords of the sea. Kronosaurus dominated the warm, shallow seas along the landmasses that eventually became Australia and Queensland. Fossilized evidence indicates the creature's length reached more than 40 feet. This animal was 4 to 5 times heavier than a Tyrannosaurus rex, and could probably have eaten one for breakfast."
"And this was the creature's skull?"
"Just a section beginning about its mid-jaw, extending back to its forelimb girdle and upper rib cage. See these two holes? Heath stated as he pointed along the dorsal skull. It's hard to tell because they're crushed, but those were the creature's orbital bones or eye sockets. Kronosaurus's head was flat-topped with a set of powerful jaws larger and more destructive than that of T-Rex. Each upper and lower jaw contained 20 to 25 teeth. The rest of the body was ellipsoidal, very streamlined, with two pairs of elongated limbs which acted like wing-shaped flippers. The torso tapered back, ending in a short, muscular tail. The rather large limb girdles we've collected from other fossils indicate the creatures were pursuit predators, capable of swimming very fast through the sea. Benedict stared at the fossil with respect. How old is this specimen? That's what's so incredible. The animal we're looking at inhabited these waters less than 2,000 years ago. What's more, this animal shows clear anatomical adaptations to its environment. Heath pointed to the crushed ribcage along the wider end of the skull. Again, it's difficult to tell because of the overwhelming damage, but these grooves along either side of the gastral ribcage appear to be gill slits.
Gill slits? I thought this was a reptile.
It is, or rather it was. What you're looking at is a prehistoric marine reptile that adapted to a deep water habitat by growing gills. This particular species apparently evolved over tens of millions of years in order to exist within the unique environmental conditions of the Mariana Trench.
Then you believe the Prometheus was attacked by chronosaurs?
As unbelievable as it sounds, yes. Look, we know that most of the dinosaurs disappeared worldwide at the end of the Mesozoic era, about 65 million years ago. The ancient marine reptiles disappeared about the same time, but their extinction was more gradual, due to a steady drop in sea temperatures. Reptiles, being cold-blooded, rely on the sun as their main source of energy and heat. Scientists always believed that life couldn't exist without the sun. The discovery of hydrothermal vents in 1977 changed all that. Now we know that bacteria and other sea creatures of the abyss are able to utilize sulfur and other chemicals that spew out of hydrothermal vents. Instead of photosynthesis, these creatures rely on chemosynthesis.
You're not telling me anything new, Professor.
I realize that, sir, but everything I've just said leads up to an incredible theory I have about the trench.
Heath pulled out a U.S. Geological Survey map of the South Pacific. A red line circled the arching chain of the Mariana Islands. The dark outline of the Mariana Trench ran parallel, just east of the landmass, as if shadowing it.
We know the Mariana Trench, Ridge, and the adjacent Mariana Islands were all formed by the continuous subduction of the Pacific Plate thrusting beneath the Philippine Plate. This tectonic process has probably gone on for billions of years. At one time, the Mariana Islands, which are a classic example of an active chain of stratovolcanoes, were all, in fact, once underwater. 100 million years ago, the area from here to the Australian landmass was a warm tropical sea teeming with all sorts of prehistoric species of fish and reptiles, and at the top of the food chain were the chronosaurs. 65 million years ago, an asteroid collision set off a series of mass extinctions. Sea levels dropped, the air cooled, as did water temperatures. Chronosaurus, being a reptile, suddenly found the sun no longer capable of sustaining its body temperature. Desperate for warmth, many of these creatures would have ventured into the deepest, warmer depths of the Mariana Trench, where the superheated waters rising from hydrothermal vents act like a primordial furnace, allowing the marine reptile to maintain its body heat.
Interesting, Benedict said, stroking his goatee. So the Mariana Trench became an oasis for certain prehistoric species of marine life.
Exactly.
This animal, Professor, what killed it?
The only natural enemy the Kronosaurus had was Carcharodon megalodon. Even though the sharks didn't evolve until much later in the Cretaceous, megalodon was bigger, meaner, and better equipped to handle changes in water temperatures. Fossilized records of megalodon teeth indicate the sharks continued to thrive in oceans all over the world up until the last ice age, about 100,000 to 2 million years ago.
Heath glanced at his watch.
I've read Jonas Taylor's theories on how Carcharodon megalodon managed to survive extinction after the last ice age by inhabiting the warm bottom layers of the Mariana Trench. The one thing I always questioned was how these enormous sharks could survive, isolated in the abyss with only a limited food supply. It turns out that the food supply wasn't limited at all. Kronosaurs had been proliferating in the trench for tens of millions of years, long before the first megalodon ever sought refuge in the gorge. Of course, once Megalodon moved into the trench, the hunters became the hunted.
Heath pointed to a series of holes lining the ribcage of the fossil.
See these holes? Heath said. They're bite marks. This Kronosaurus was killed by a Megalodon.
The shark clamped its jaws onto the animal's head and upper torso, chomping through bone in one powerful bite that not only crushed its prey's spine, but actually severed the marine reptile in two.
I'll bet the reason these Kronosaurus now hunt in packs is to defend themselves against Megalodon attacks.
So the Mysterium Tremendum is finally resolved. And how do you propose we defend ourselves against this pack of Kronosaurs?
In the Mariana Trench, size matters. The Kronosaurs are nearly as large as the Prometheus, so they'll continue to attack. But even four of these beasts are no match for the Benthus, the largest moving thing in the trench. My advice is simple. Keep the Benthus close at all times, even if it means delaying the completion of your mission.
I understand.
Heath turned as Sergei entered the lab.
Sergei, wait for me in the corridor, please, Benedict said. I'll be right with you.
He turned back to Heath, extending his hand.
Better get down to G-Deck, Professor.
Heath smiled, shaking Benedict's hand. Instead of releasing his grip, Benedict placed his left hand over the inside of the paleobiologist's wrist, feigning a gesture of warmth.
One last question before you go, Benedict said,
positioning the fingertips of his left hand over the man's pulse.
Have you ever heard of Devil's Purgatory?
Heath's eyes locked onto Benedict's, the CIA agent's pulse racing.
Devil's Purgatory? No, never heard of it. Sounds like a kid's ride. Why do you ask?
Benedict smiled, releasing the professor's hand.
No reason. Again, thank you, and have a safe journey. Your information has helped me to see things much more clearly.
Terry hastily tossed her belongings into her travel bag. Word had spread quickly about the Prometheus's early departure, and she was determined to be one of the first on board. A knock startled her.
Who is it?
Sergei, I am to escort you to sub.
Terry felt herself break into a cold sweat.
That's okay, I'm fine, thank you.
I wait for you here, replied the Russian.
Terry sat down on the edge of her bed, her body trembling. She stared at her travel bag, tears of frustration and anger welling in her eyes. She knew that Sergei had no intention of escorting her to the sub. The message had been delivered, its meaning quite clear. Terry was now a fly in Benedict's web. She would not be permitted to leave the Benthos alive. Seafood. The William Beebe. 7:35 a.m. Jonas opened the cabin door. Mac entered, giving him a scowl.
Late night? He said accusingly.
Meaning?
Meaning I hope you're more focused on avenging Deef's death than on fucking Celeste. You're way out of line. Celeste and I went into town to pick up supplies. We had dinner, that's all. Nothing happened and nothing will.
Mac held up his hands.
Fine, my fault.
And as far as killing the Meg, you don't have to lecture me on being focused. I'm Captain fucking Ahab, remember?
Have you come up with a plan?
Yes.
Good.
Mac rubbed the back of his neck.
Look, I'm sorry, Jonas. I'm just a bit on edge.
I know. Deef was a good guy.
Yeah, he was.
Mac pinched his nose, wiping back a tear.
We should have blown this motherfucking fish away years ago.
Is your new chopper ready?
Yeah.
Then let's go find Angel. Vancouver Island, 10 miles south of Barclay Sound. Andrea Jacobs held up her hand, signaling the rest of the group to stop paddling. She pointed to a spot 100 yards ahead. Turning around in the seat of her kayak, she glanced back at the others and smiled. Her husband, Ronald, gave her a thumbs up in the kayak directly behind her. Karen McNeil, the group's leader, slid her craft into position to his left. Andrea's staff writer, Shirley Collin, gave an encouraging wave from the front of her 2-seat kayak. Her husband, John, seated behind her, busy reloading his camera. Andrea maneuvered the bow of her kayak to face south. Then she sat back and waited, her adrenaline pumping. It had taken more than 2 years of prodding before Andrea's travel editor had finally agreed to greenlight a feature article on Vancouver Island. Lying to the west of the city of Vancouver, parallel to the main coast of British Columbia, the island, the largest in the eastern Pacific, possessed the kind of dramatic geography, variety of wildlife, and contrasting weather conditions that made it an ideal spot for vacationers who enjoyed rugged, get-back-to-nature experiences. Arriving in Port Hardy by ferry, the two couples had spent their first week hiking mountain trails and exploring the granite peaks and alpine glaciers, which ran like a spine along the center of the island. Andrea had photographed majestic snow-capped mountain peaks, hordes of nobly crowned elk, bald eagles soaring in flight, and even several black bear pulling salmon from a stream. But it was whales she was really after, big ones. That meant exploring the cold and hazardous ocean waters off the island's western coastline. Andrea had to convince Kieran McNeil that their group was experienced enough to handle the rigors of sea kayaking, the best method for getting close to the pods. And so they had put in at Pacific Rim National Park that morning, staying relatively close to shore as they traveled north through rough coastal waters. Now all their effort was about to pay off. Andrea pulled the hood of her dry suit over her head, then positioned her face mask and snorkel. Her heart fluttered with excitement. Securing the underwater camera around her neck, she grasped the paddle tightly and waited. With a great quiff of air, the killer whale surfaced, the shiny hooked black dorsal fins of the females dwarfed by the 3-foot blade-like fin of the males. Remaining close to the surface as they closed on the kayakers, the pod of orcas rose and dived in a gentle rhythmic pattern. Andrea sucked in a deep breath of air and rolled sideways, plunging herself and the rotating kayak into the icy Canadian waters. Suspended upside down, secure in her seat, she watched in awe as the pod emerged through the misty, deep blue underworld. Aiming the underwater camera, she quickly snapped off a dozen pictures as low-frequency whistles and high-pitched clicking sounds filled the water all around her. As the pod glided to her right, a 33-foot male appeared out of the mist, moving in to take a closer look. Andrea's heart pounded wildly in her chest as the incredible creature hovered 5 feet away, the mammal's mouth large enough to engulf her entire upper torso in one bite. She took several more pictures, overwhelmed by the sheer majesty and intelligence of the creature, then watched as it swam away, disappearing into the blue haze with the rest of the pod. Pushing down hard with the paddle, Andrea flipped herself over, feeling her husband's assistance along the back of the kayak. She spit out the snorkel and gasped for air, her face tingling from the cold.
"That was absolutely incredible," she announced to the group.
Her husband tossed her a towel.
"You take years off my life every time you do that."
"Isn't the water freezing?" Shirley asked.
"It's really not that bad," Andrea said. "The dry suit keeps me warm. My cheeks just freeze up a bit."
She turned to Karen.
"I thought you said orcas preferred the eastern coast of the island."
"Our local pods do," the group leader said. "Johnstone Strait, which is on the northeastern side of the island, is the summer home to 13 resident orca pods, the group that just passed by our transients."
"How can you tell?" John asked.
"Only transients stay to the ocean side of the island. They prefer to hunt seal and sea lions on their way to the Bering Sea. Our locals prefer fish, and their pods are much larger in number."
"Orcas are great, but you can photograph them at SeaWorld," Andrea said. "What I want to see are the big whales."
"They'll be a little farther out," Karen said. "What I suggest we do is continue to stay within a half mile of shore. In about an hour, we'll cross Barkley Sound on our way to Uslalet. At that point, we'll be in open ocean and should run into some grays, perhaps even a pot of humpbacks. Are you sure you're up to handling 6 to 9 foot swells?"
"We'll be fine," Andrea said, winking at Shirley.
"If the men can't handle it, we'll leave them ashore."
Jonas watched the shadow of their helicopter pass over the Cape Flattery lighthouse. Moments later, they were flying over water, heading northwest, approaching Vancouver Island.
"Welcome to Canada, eh?" Max said.
Jonas ignored him, staring at the ocean.
"What's the matter, Jonas? You hardly said a word all afternoon."
"I've just got a lot on my mind."
"Celeste or the shark?"
"Both." Mac lifted his sunglasses and looked Jonas in the eye.
"Take my advice and keep your distance from both."
"I told you I'm not interested in Celeste."
"Come on, pal, you're not the least bit attracted?"
"No comment."
"She came on to you last night, didn't she?"
Jonas grinned. "You might say that."
"And you just turned her away?"
"Told her I wasn't interested. We'll never be anything more than friends."
"Friends? Christ, Jonas, wake up. You'd be better off fucking her once and getting it over with than to elevate her to a position of trust."
"Actually, we've had some pretty interesting talks."
"Oh, well, ain't that sweet. Maybe you guys can take an aerobics class together when you get back to Monterey.
And what makes you such an expert on women?
I don't know anyone who thinks with his pecker more than you do." "Hey, even my pecker's smart enough to know when someone's playing me for a fool,"
You think Celeste would be shoving her titties in your face if she wasn't after something? No offense, pal, but you ain't exactly Mel Gibson.
Maybe she's lonely.
Wrong. Celeste is cold-blooded. She doesn't give a shit about anyone but herself. If she's making nice with you, it's only because she needs you.
Needs me for what? Marin's handling everything.
Don't fool yourself. There's a reason she brought you along, and it's not to play footsies under the breakfast table. Stop being taken in by all that false charm she turns on and off like a faucet. That William Beebe ain't the love boat. Celeste is nothing more than a female version of Benedict.
That's another thing. She told me Benedict has had his way with her sexually since she was 14. I can't tell if she loves him or fears him.
Probably both.
Mac banked to the west, guiding the helicopter across the strait of Juan de Fuca toward the Canadian border. Jonas focused his binoculars on Vancouver Island, looming ahead on the horizon.
Okay, Ann Landers, tell me something. If Celeste fears Benedict, why won't she leave him?
Mac grinned.
I'll answer that for you in one word. Power. He's got it and she wants it. I'll bet she's still spreading her legs for him.
Then why is she interested in me?
I told you, Jonas, she wants something. You've heard the saying that men use love to get sex and women use sex to get love? Well, Celeste uses sex to manipulate people into doing what she wants, and that's when she's most dangerous.
The chopper descended over the southern tip of the island.
Should I head over deeper waters or follow the coastline?
Coastline. Jonas focused on a pod of orcas making their way north. For the next several minutes, they rowed in silence, Jonas scanning the surface. Somehow, he hoped to detect some type of disturbance or whale remains that would indicate the presence of the elusive albino predator. He felt frustration building inside. Angel hadn't been sighted in nearly 3 days. This is hopeless. Mac, do you think people can change?
Oh, boy, she's really got her claws into you, doesn't she?
Actually, I was talking about me. With a resounding blast from its horn, the ferry, MV Lady Rose, pulled away from the docks at Bamfield, continuing its 10-hour round-trip journey to Uslalit. 14-year-old Kevin Blaine rested his forehead on top of the polished wooden rail, feeling the reverberations of the ship's engines as he kicked the iron support post with his foot.
"Kevin, knock it off!" his older sister Devin yelled. "You're annoying the other passengers."
"I'm bored. Why can't I skateboard? I told you, it's too crowded on deck."
"How much longer till we're in Uslalit?"
The 19-year-old grabbed her brother by his arm.
"Kevin, will you shut the hell up? You're driving me crazy. I swear to God, if Mom and Dad ever make me take you to Port Alberni again, I'll kill you first. I'm hungry."
"Here,"
she said, slapping a $10 bill into his hand.
"Now go. I don't want to see you again until we dock."
The Predator made its way north against the strong currents of Imperial Eagle Channel, remaining close to the rocky coral bottom as it continued its search. Swinging its elephantine head from side to side, the Megalodon inhaled a trough full of sea, its olfactory senses detecting the faint, acrid odor of urine. A half mile away, an adult male sea lion pirouetted gracefully just below the waves. At just over 600 pounds, the mammal feared only the orcopods. Survival instinct told the agile bull just how far it could stray from shore in order to escape attack. With visibility at just over 30 feet, the large male, always on the lookout, would not venture more than 50 yards from shore. The hunter moved swiftly along the seafloor, quickly closing the distance between itself and the heartbeat of the sea lion. Ascending slowly beneath its prey, the megalodon searched the sunlit surface, homing in on its unseen meal. Sensing danger, the sea lion propelled itself quickly toward shore. The female detected a dark silhouette of movement along the surface. She launched upward from the bottom, whipping her muscular tail in swift, calculated strokes. The bull registered the disturbance below. Trapped on the surface, it twisted and thrashed, attempting to deflect the impending bite of the unseen predator. The megalodon burst through the surface, eyes rolled back, jaws fully hyperextended, engulfing the sea lion in one horrific bite. The pinniped's blubbery girth was instantly crushed beneath 50,000 pounds per square inch of pressure, sending streams of blood and excrement gushing out from between rows of razor-sharp teeth. It was just after 4 in the afternoon when the 5 kayakers moved beyond the last of the broken group islands of Barkley Sound. Heading into open ocean, Ronald Jacobs noticed a bald eagle circling overhead as they passed the final vestige of land for the next several miles. He stopped paddling, following the flight of the majestic bird until it perched in the upper branches of a fir tree 300 yards away.
"Okay," Karen said. "It's 4 miles to Uslalet. Watch for swells. It can get really nasty out here."
"Looks like we've got company," John said.
He pointed south. A ferry was approaching in the distance.
"That's the Lady Rose," Karen said. "She'll be taking us from Uslalet back up the channel to Port Alberni tomorrow afternoon."
"We're not leaving until I get some good underwater photos," Andrea said. "What happened to those whale pods you promised me?"
"There's 40 to 50 grays that spend the spring and summer months feeding between Barkley Sound and Clayoquot Sound, which is another 30 miles to the north. There's always a few minke whales about, as well as humpbacks. Be patient," said Karen. "We'll spot something before too long."
Kevin Blaine leaned over the starboard bow and spit, watching the wind carry it 20 feet back before it hit the water. Most of the other passengers on the Lady Rose were either napping on the rows of wooden benches or had gone inside to get out of the weather. He stared at the blue ocean, hoping to see a whale, when an ivory blur, half as long as the ferry, soared into view well below the surface. Kevin leaned out over the rail as far as he could, gawking at the creature, which was moving parallel to the boat. Seconds later it descended, disappearing from sight. Kevin ran to his sister, who was lying on one of the benches, working on her tan.
"Deb, I just saw something huge. I think it was the megalodon."
"Go away.
You're not listening. Why don't you make yourself useful and get me a Diet Coke?"
Kevin ignored her and ran back to the bow.
"There," Karen said, pointing ahead to their left. "Looks like we're in luck. They're feeding off phytoplankton blooms."
"What's that?" Ronald asked,
paddling harder to keep up with his wife. He paused as a series of 7-foot swells lifted his kayak, soaking him with freezing water.
"It's that white stuff that looks like bathtub foam," Karen said, rolling with the swell. "Every spring the sun causes the phytoplankton to bloom like crazy. Small larvae and fish feed off of it, attracting baleen whales."
They approached to within 50 feet of the feeding pod.
"What kind of whales are these?"
Shirley asked.
"Grays. I count 5, maybe 6 adults and a calf. Let's not get any closer."
Andrea pulled the dry suit hood over her head and positioned her face mask. She checked her camera for film, verifying a new roll.
"Wish me luck,"
she said, rolling sideways into the ocean. Even wearing the dry suit, the chilly water took her breath away. She looked around, realizing immediately that she was still too far away from the pod to see anything. Then, just as she was about to roll upright, she spotted a ghostly form gliding through the deeper waters directly beneath her, heading toward the whales. Paddling hard, Andrea pulled herself back into an upright position.
"I can't believe it," she said, water pouring off her face. "I just saw a beluga whale."
"Are you certain?" Karen said. "Belucas usually don't venture this far south."
"I'm telling you, I saw it."
She picked up her paddle.
"What are you doing?" her husband asked.
"The beluga was heading toward the pod. I need to get closer. I'm too far away to shoot."
"Too late,"
Shirley said, pointing. The grays had stopped feeding.
"Something's spooking them," Karen said. "They're closing formation."
Without warning, the pod began moving en masse toward the kayakers.
"Oh, shit! Stay close and hold on!" Karen yelled.
The 30-ton leviathans tore up the surface as they accelerated at them, sounding seconds before they would have struck the kayaks. The four boats tossed wildly about, spinning and crashing into one another. Andrea sucked in a lungful of air and rolled sideways, her camera already positioned in front of her mask. A series of 7 to 8 foot swells rolled at them, lifting and dropping the kayaks precariously. And then the sea calmed, the whales out of sight.
"Everyone all right?" Karen asked.
"I'm freezing,"
Shirley said. John removed a towel from one of the watertight compartments and handed it to his wife. Ronald turned to Andrea's kayak, which was still inverted.
"At least someone's enjoying herself." "Let's go home, Shirley," John said. "I've had enough wilderness to last me a lifetime. The next time your magazine wants to do a wildlife piece, suggest Manhattan."
Ronald reached out to help his wife flip her kayak right side up. That's when he saw the cardinal red cloud pooling around the craft.
"Andrea!"
Ronald spun the kayak over and screamed. Shirley stared, then turned and retched over the side. Karen and John looked on in shock, clutching their mouths. All that remained of Andrea Jacobs was a gushing scarlet stump of mangled flesh, the lower torso still wedged in the kayak, severed at the stomach.
Ronald stopped screaming as the 7-foot stark white dorsal fin surged out of the surf. It circled the group twice, then submerged.
"It's the Megalodon!"
John rasped, holding on as the kayaks were lifted by another series of swells. He leaned forward and caught his wife's head as she fainted. Ronald's eyes bugged out as an unearthly glow appeared beneath him. He gasped in horror as the enormous head rose vertically to his left, engulfing the remains of his wife and her kayak in its powerful jaws. Two vicious chomps, and the shark slid back into the sea, leaving only a paddle and a section of bow bobbing on the surface.
"Move!" Karen yelled. "Split up!"
She paddled south, heading for the ferry. John watched her go, then reached forward and slapped his wife hard across her face.
"Shirley, wake up!"
he yelled, shaking her. Feeling her stir, he released her head and began paddling toward Uslalit, 2.5 miles to the north. Still in shock, Ronald Jacobs remained motionless in his kayak and wept. Jonas focused his binoculars on the ferry, then spotted something else.
"Looks like a kayak. It's heading straight for the ferry.
Jonas, behind the kayak. 1 o'clock.
Jonas searched the ocean.
"Oh, fuck. Hold on."
The helicopter soared past the Lady Rose as Jonas desperately attempted to hail the ferry on the radio. Alone in the bow, Kevin watched the woman paddle furiously toward the boat. He ducked instinctively as the helicopter soared overhead, then spotted the dorsal fin and realized what was taking place before his eyes. Spinning around, he searched the deck, locating the life ring. He tore it from the rail as the Lady Rose swung to port to intercept the woman. Groaning out loud, with her shoulders, arms, and back aching from the anaerobic effort, Karen switched sides, paddling on her right as she headed toward the ferry. Blisters on her hands began bleeding. Her tears and the splashing salt water were blinding. 50 yards. She focused on the bow, her mind racing, wondering how she would possibly reach the rail that towered 15 feet above her head. Then she spotted the boy tying off the rope. The predator rose, jaws agape, its eyes focused on the silhouette of the fleeing kayak. In the murky water, the figure resembled another sea lion. The megalodon closed to within 40 feet, then detected the larger creature change course, approaching its prey. Kevin felt the ferry cut its engines. He looked up to see 3 members of the crew running toward him. Calling to the woman below, he reached out and tossed her the ring. Physically exhausted, her arms trembling, Karen guided the kayak alongside the moving ferry. She lunged forward and grabbed the ring. Looping her right arm inside, she managed to free her lower body from the boat, but was unable to muster the strength to pull herself upward. The 3 crewmen pushed Kevin aside and grabbed the rope. Karen felt herself being hauled upward. She held on tight, praying the monster would spare her. A crowd gathered. Unable to see, Kevin climbed up to straddle the rail. Mac hovered the chopper 80 feet above the deck of the ferry. Jonas watched the scene below, breathing a sigh of relief as the crew reached out and pulled the woman to safety.
"Can you get off a shot with the grenade rifle?" Mac asked.
Jonas peered down the scope of the weapon, searching for the creature.
"She's too deep to see, and I'm getting a bad reflection from the sun. I can't tell how close she is to the ferry."
Reaching beneath the seat, he pulled out a large handgun resembling a starter's pistol. Lodged in the barrel was a small transmitter attached to a 7-inch barbed hook. He pulled the safety off the pistol, then activated the transmitter.
"Where'd you get that?" Mac asked.
"Had the Institute deliver it while we were in port. It only transmits over a 3-mile radius, but..."
Without warning, the megalodon rose from the sea, its vertical momentum sending its upper torso high into the air as its jaws clamped down on the empty kayak. Falling forward, the leviathan slammed sideways against the ferry, its weight knocking the Lady Rose hard to starboard. Most of the ship's passengers and crew found themselves sprawling on their backs. Kevin Blaine squeezed his legs around the rail, holding on precariously as he gawked at the gargantuan beast, its huge pectoral fin so close he could have reached out and touched it. As the creature's upper torso slammed hard against the side of the ferry, the rail jolted out from under him, and he tumbled forward, twisting in midair, catching a glimpse of blue sky before plunging headfirst into the icy sea. Afraid he might hit the ferry, Jonas lowered the grenade rifle and grabbed the pistol. In one motion he aimed and fired, the barbed arrow and transmitter exploding from the barrel, puncturing the megalodon along its exposed underbelly. Bouncing off the vessel, the monster rolled sideways back into the water. A strong swimmer, Kevin quickly righted himself underwater and kicked hard to the surface. More cold than scared, he looked up, waiting for someone to appear at the rail with the rope. Devon picked herself up off the deck and rushed to the rail, shocked at having witnessed her brother fall. She quickly spotted him treading water, waving at her along the surface.
"Kevin, hold on!"
She saw the end of the nylon rope tied off on the rail and started pulling in the slack, the life ring appearing from across the deck. Grabbing the flotation device, she tossed it overboard. The ghost-like demon had reappeared. Gliding gracefully on its side, it opened its mouth, its lower jawline moving silently across the surface. A channel of water streamed into the dark tunnel of the widening orifice. Devon freaked out. A dozen passengers yelled and screamed in her ear as she motioned wildly for Kevin to grab the life ring. Kevin's smile disappeared as he saw the expression of terror on his sister's face. He turned around. The ivory head lying on its side was barely visible. A small wake closed, revealing a black hole in the sea, outlined by pink gums and sickening teeth. A rush of panic washed over him. Ignoring the life ring, he tried to swim away, but an overpowering current grabbed him, dragging him backward in the water. For a surreal moment, Kevin felt the bizarre feeling of sliding feet first down a hole, water rushing along either side of him. A torrent of ocean washed over him, pushing him downward. Daylight disappeared. For a suffocating moment, the boy clawed in complete darkness along the slimy surface of the monster's tongue. And then he tumbled backward, crushed into oblivion. Jonas slammed his face against the cockpit door and howled in rage as the creature disappeared beneath the waves. Max shifted the hovering chopper to autopilot, too shaken to even grip the joystick. For the next several minutes, the two men could do nothing but seethe, their eyes closed tight, the horrifying scene refusing to cease replaying in their mind's eyes.
"Chopper, come in. This is the captain of the Lady Rose. Chopper, come in."
"What?" Jonas said, not recognizing his own voice.
"Chopper, the woman we rescued says there are two more kayaks out there, half mile northwest. Reply, please, over."
He looked at Mac, his friend's face red with rage. Mac gripped the joystick, the airship leaping forward.
"We're on it!"
Jonas yelled, his own adrenaline pumping. Retracing the woman's direction, they searched the ocean, quickly spotting the kayak. The chopper swooped downward. Mac hovered the copter just above the surface, watching a series of incoming swells.
"Do it fast, Jonas."
Jonas unbuckled his harness and moved back to the cargo bay. Pulling open the sliding bay door, he reached out for the unconscious man and grabbed hold of one of his arms. Jonas hauled Ronald Jacobs from his kayak and into the chopper, as the airship leapfrogged over an 8-foot swell.
"Is he alive?" Mac asked. "He's breathing, but he's in shock."
Jonas covered the man with blankets while Mac circled to the east, looking for the other kayak. Out of breath and his muscles trembling from lactic acid buildup, John Cullen was forced to stop paddling.
"Shirley, I need your help," he rasped.
He rubbed the sweat from his eyes and tried to focus on a sliver of land still a half mile away. Shirley dipped the end of her oar into the water, attempting to paddle.
"John, I can't. I'm going to be sick again."
John was looking behind them, watching the ferry in the distance.
"Something's going on back there."
He reached overboard, splashing water onto his face, the cold helping to revive him.
"Shirley, look at me."
As his wife turned, he drenched her with an oar splash of water.
"God damn you!"
"Now pick up your paddle and help me row," he ordered.
The megalodon continued circling below the ferry, waiting for more prey to appear, when a thrumming sound resonated somewhere in the distance. The baritone vibrations continued, enticing the shark away from the boat to investigate. As it closed on the source, the beating abruptly ceased. The shark circled, confused, waiting for the voodoo-like beats to reappear. Instead, another sound caught the creature's attention, this one moving along the surface. The female whipped its caudal fin, homing in on the remaining kayak. John glanced up from paddling to see the reassuring glow of lights coming from a building situated at the entrance to a private pier.
"Straight ahead, Shirley!" he yelled, stroking harder. We're almost there!"
Shirley turned, then stopped paddling, staring at the expanse of ocean behind them.
"Shirley, don't stop!"
"John!"
Her brown eyes widened with fear. The dorsal fin was closing on them. Jonas continued listening to the beeping of the homing transmitter as he scanned the choppy surface, the fading light from the setting sun making it difficult to see.
"Signal's weakening. Try circling back."
The helicopter banked away from the broken group islands, racing for the southernmost tip of Ustlalet.
"Mac, there!"
Jonas pointed.
Looks like they're heading for that pier. And look who's escorting them in.
The muscles in John Collins' back burned. His forearms ached. His hands were so sore from bleeding blisters that he could barely maintain his grip on the paddle. A sudden movement caused him to turn to his right. Out of the sea rose a 3-foot wake, buffeting the kayak sideways. The ghost surfaced, gliding effortlessly on its side, its luminescent skin tinged with an orange glow from the fading sunlight. A soulless gray eye looked up at John from just below the waterline. The jaw quivered open, exposing the points of its teeth. Shirley shrieked. Adrenaline and fear drove John's oar through the sea. He continued staring at the shark as he paddled, mesmerized by its impossible size. Tearing himself away, he searched for the end of the pier. 40 yards ahead. The fish slapped its tail along the surface and submerged.
"Oh, God! Oh, God! This is it!" John yelled. "It's coming up from under to attack, just like it did before! Shirley, free your legs from the kayak and get ready to jump!"
She stopped paddling, twisting her body loose.
"I'm free! Now you!"
she called out, balancing on her knees as she paddled. John fought to pull his lower body from the boat, his legs feeling numb from sitting too long. His arm shook with exhaustion and adrenaline. As one leg pulled free, he saw the water turn white beneath them.
"Shirley, jump! Jump!"
The megalodon's head launched from the sea, its eyes rolling back as its jaws widened to sandwich the kayak. Shirley and John felt their boat rising beneath them and jumped. The giant bear trap of a maw snapped shut, crushing the empty kayak as the two boaters flew through the air and tumbled into the sea. The blast of freezing water sent John into action. Righting himself, he quickly kicked to the surface, only to feel the creature's submerging bulk momentarily drag him back down again. John's mind screamed at him to kick harder. He resurfaced, relieved to see his wife already swimming to the pier less than 20 feet away. He raised a dead, tired arm to stroke, terrified to find he could barely move, his muscles heavy as lead. Shirley reached for the edge of the dilapidated dock and pulled herself up, scraping her arms as she rolled onto the decking. She sat up, chest heaving, and screamed as loud as she could,
"John, swim faster!"
Below the surface, the megalodon shook its head to and fro, unable to locate its prey among the remains of the kayak. A second later, it homed in on the telltale vibrations along the surface. The shark turned, whipping its head and tail back and forth in an effort to regain its forward momentum. John had reached the edge of the pier but was beyond exhaustion, unable to even raise his hand out of the water to pull himself to safety. Shirley reached down and grabbed her husband's wrist. Tug as she might, she was unable to budge the 200-pound man. Then she saw the surface churn 30 feet behind him. The terror in his wife's bulging eyes was enough. Adrenaline pumping, John scrambled onto the pier, then grabbed Shirley by her waist and leaped sideways. The head of the rampaging beast struck the wharf, obliterating two of the wooden pilings, sending an entire section of the deck crashing into the sea, John and Shirley with it. Like a mad bull lusting after blood, the megalodon turned its jaws upon the swirling debris, chomping along the surface as it blindly searched for its prey. John pushed his wife up a short wooden ladder as 4-foot waves crested over his back. As he climbed onto the damaged pier, he turned to see the shark gliding in from behind. He grabbed Shirley's hand and ran, hearing the dull thud of their footsteps across the weathered wooden planks, the crashing sea on either side of them. Sensing the vibrations of its fleeing prey, the megalodon slipped beneath the pier, homing in on the source of the sounds. John turned as the pier shook. The decking behind them exploded into splinters as the monstrous shark, in its madness to feed, smashed its triangular snout upward through the wooden planks.
"Faster!"
he yelled, trying his best not to stumble as he pulled Shirley toward the gated entrance of the private pier.
"Damn it!"
A 15-foot-high chain-link construction fence blocked their escape. The barrier continued to their right, fastened to the side of a seafood restaurant situated on an adjacent pier. John tried the gate while his wife ran to the side of the restaurant, pounding on a metal fire door. Without warning, the wooden planks beneath his feet fractured, driven upward by the predator's conical snout. John grabbed onto the fence, clutching the aluminum links between his fingers, holding on for dear life as the decking beneath his feet collapsed into the sea. Swirling below the dark waters and splintered planks was a white glow.
"John, this way!"
John swung himself sideways, stepping gingerly over the gap and onto a wooden walkway bordering the side of the restaurant. Shirley grabbed his hand, pulling him through an open gate and onto the pier supporting the main dining area of the restaurant.
"Shirley, wait, we're going the wrong way!
There's a balcony out back. We have to go through the restaurant to get off the pier!"
Shirley led him past bay windows encircling the glass-enclosed banquet room. Startled patrons looked up from candlelit dinners, unaware of the creature circling beneath the pier. Shirley banged on the outer glass balcony door. John saw the luminescent fin rise. A waiter walked toward the door, shaking his head. He pointed to the side, directing them to the front entrance, as a tremendous force shook one of the pilings supporting the pier. John banged on the thick glass.
"Open the fucking door or I'll kick it in!"
The waiter backed away as another man, obviously a manager, approached, unlatching the door. Shirley yanked open the door, John practically pushing her into the lavish dining room. They stood there, dripping wet, catching their breath.
"Madame, you cannot—"
"Get everyone out of here!"
Shirley yelled.
"The pier's collapsing!"
Shirley led her husband past the stunned diners, searching for the way out.
"Madame, monsieur—"
"You heard my wife, Frenchie. Get everyone off this—"
With a colossal boom, the entire restaurant shook in an earthquake-like upheaval that shattered the bay windows and sent patrons and their entrees toppling onto the floor. Above the din of protests and screams, John heard a tremendous crack as one of the damaged pilings collapsed beneath the pier. The restaurant began to tilt. John grabbed Shirley's hand and ran, pushing and shoving through a maze of tables and dozens of people now scrambling toward the front entrance. Hovering high above the melee, Jonas and Mac could only watch as the back end of the restaurant cracked off and collapsed, tumbling into the sea. Solutions. Mariana Trench. Sergei waited in the corridor outside Terry's door until the Prometheus pushed away from its docking sleeve.
"Decided to stay, eh?"
called out the Russian in broken English, laughing sadistically as he made his way down the corridor. Terry sat on the floor, fighting to remain calm. The knock startled her.
"It's Benedict."
She wiped her face and opened the door.
"My dear, why on earth are you still aboard?"
he asked innocently.
"The Prometheus departed early this morning."
"Who are you kidding? Your Russian goon's been sitting outside my door for the last few hours."
"Sergei?"
Benedict shook his head.
"I didn't know."
"Sure you didn't. Is this how you get yourself off, Benedict, by screwing with other people's emotions?" Benedict's eyes flashed a warning.
"We'll speak again after you've regained control of your emotions."
She watched him disappear down the corridor. Terry slammed the cabin door shut. She waited 10 minutes, then reopened it, and made a dash for the companionway. She ascended 2 levels and ran through the corridor leading to Heath's lab. Terry knocked, then pushed open the door. The room was empty. Locking the door behind her, she hurried through to the adjoining room, looking for the government agent. The fossilized skull stared back at her. Distraught, she left the lab and headed upstairs to B-deck. She spotted Captain Hopp in the control room. Remembering how he had stood up to Benedict, she approached, pulling him aside.
"Are you all right?" he asked. "You shouldn't be here.
Can I speak with you in private?"
"The Epimetheus should be arriving momentarily," the captain said, more for his crew than for her. "Come upstairs. We'll watch her as she descends."
Terry followed him up the access tube ladder into the observation deck. She waited impatiently while he activated the observation dome, retracting the titanium outer covering from the reinforced Lexan glass.
"Speak quietly," he said. "The walls have ears."
"Benedict's keeping me on board like some kind of prisoner."
"I know."
"Can't you help me?"
I'm not sure."
"Where's Heath? What happened to him?"
"The paleobiologist? I believe he left earlier this morning aboard the Prometheus."
Her heart sank. How could he have left without taking her?
"Captain, please, I have to get off this ship."
Hop appeared nervous.
What can I do?"
"Radio the authorities for help."
Hop shook his head. "All comlinks aboard the Benthos and her subs are routed through the Goliath. There's no way to bypass the system."
Terry felt tears of desperation welling in her eyes. "Can you pilot the Epimetheus?" The question seemed to perturb the captain.
"We wouldn't get very far. We certainly can't outrun the Goliath."
"How close is the nearest island?"
"About 120 nautical miles due west of our present position."
"We could make it." Captain Hopp turned to face the abyss. He nodded toward a faint light in the distance.
"Here comes the Epimetheus," he muttered.
"Captain, please." For a long moment, Hopp stared at his dark reflection in the glass.
"I've been with Benedict for more than 20 years. He took me in. At the time, I was a useless alcoholic who had just killed my wife and little girl driving drunk."
Hopp looked into her eyes, wiping back a tear.
I guess my daughter'd be about your age now.
You'd be saving my life.
I want you to return to your cabin and remain there. Don't speak to anyone. I'll meet you on G-Deck at 300 hours.
For the next 14 hours, Terry remained locked in her cabin, anxiously awaiting her chance to escape her benthic prison. Benedict had wasted little time. The moment the Epimetheus had docked, he ordered the sub into the trench, this time keeping the Benthos hovering close by. Terry heard the sub redock sometime after midnight. At this point, she had no idea what Geotech was doing in the Abyss, but had decided the deployment of the Unis robots was nothing more than a clever ruse to disguise Benedict's own personal quest. At 3:10 a.m, Terry opened the door to her cabin, the iron bar clenched firmly in her right fist. Barefoot, shoes in hand, she quietly made her way down the 2 flights of the companionway, stepping out onto G-Deck. She waited in the barren corridor and listened. Someone's voice, coming from the hangar. Captain Hopp? Hurrying down the deserted corridor, she approached the watertight door, surprised to find it slightly ajar. She peeked through the crack and saw Captain Hopp squatting on his knees by the far wall, his back to her. Terry entered the hangar, pushing the thick door shut behind her. "Captain, what are you doing in here?" As she touched the man's shoulder, he tumbled sideways, blood gushing from his severed throat. Terry's scream was stifled by Sergei's hand.
"What kept you?"
whispered the Russian, taking her from behind. He grabbed a fistful of her long hair, then pressed the blade of his hunting knife to her throat with his free hand.
"We have a little fun before I kill you, da? Drop the weapon."
The iron bar clanged onto the floor by her feet.
"Now remove your pants," he whispered, his tongue flicking in her ear.
Terry felt the blade of his knife cut her neck, drawing blood. Reaching to her waist, she unbuckled her jeans slowly, her mind racing.
"Push them down to your ankles."
She wriggled the skin-tight jeans down over her hips, bending to maneuver them over her calves, casually slipping her right foot out of the pant leg. Panting like an animal, Sergei maintained a grip on her hair while placing the knife between his teeth, freeing one hand to pull his own pants down around his ankles. Retrieving the knife, he pressed the point to her spine.
"Bend over. Spread your legs."
Terry leaned forward, registering the point of the knife at her back. She spread her legs apart, shifting her weight, preparing herself. Sergei returned the knife to his mouth, then tore away Terry's underwear. She shook with disgust as he reached between her legs to guide himself in. "Now!" Terry mule kicked upward with her free leg, slamming her heel into Sergei's exposed genitals. The Russian howled in pain. Dropping to one knee, she strained to reach the iron bar as Sergei yanked her backward by her hair. Grabbing it, she spun around and, as hard as she could, slammed it on the Russian's skull. Sergei dropped in a heap, blood seeping from the top of his head. She backed up, then hit him again, hearing a satisfying crack. For a long moment she stood over him, wanting to scream in defiance at the vile creature. Instead, she bent down and pulled her pants back up, then leaned over the Russian and checked for a pulse. Still alive. The iron bar poised above her head, she searched the man's pockets with her free hand, removing a magnetic pass card from his shirt. The Russian began to stir. Lunging awkwardly, he grabbed her leg. She let out a half-scream, then bashed his knuckles with the metal bar. Sergei moaned in agony, releasing his grip. Terry ran to the watertight door leading to the corridor. Verifying it was sealed, she entered the hangar control room, locking the hydraulic door behind her. She scanned the control panel, locating the flood valves, and twisted them counterclockwise. Seawater poured in from ventilation pipes in the hangar's flooring. Sergei rolled over and got to his knees, clutching his head. Staggering to his feet, the Russian killer sloshed through ankle-deep water, making his way to the watertight door leading to the corridor. Terry searched the control panel. The red light verified both the corridor and control room doors could not be opened while the hangar was flooding. Sergei tugged at the corridor door like a drunk, then noticed Terry sitting in the control room. He pressed his face to the reinforced Lexan porthole, his eyes exuding a predatory malevolence. He swung his fist, pounding the glass. The water rose to his waist. Sergei banged again. She watched as his hatred changed to fear. He pounded harder, becoming desperate. The water level rose above his neck. He pressed his face to the glass and leered at her. The water level reached the ceiling. The outdoors opened. Terry watched Sergei grab his head a second before his skull imploded like a ripe melon. She turned away, then slumped in the operator's chair, emotionally exhausted. The remains of the two mutilated bodies drifted slowly toward the open hangar door, heading for the awaiting darkness of the trench. A movement caught her eye. Terry shrieked as a colossal brown head suddenly appeared from the abyss. Flat, crocodile-like jaws opened wide, revealing a frenzied row of hideous pointed teeth. Terry froze, watching in fascination and terror as the 40-foot prehistoric marine reptile pushed its head into the hangar and snatched Sergei's remains in one gargantuan bite. The beast spun upside down as it swallowed, spewing shards of flesh in all directions. Luminous scarlet eyes searched the hangar for more food. The remains of Captain Hopp moved past the beast into the trench. The freakish reptile pushed itself away from the hangar door to follow, gliding away like a sinuous eel. Still shaken, Terry pressed the controls, sealing the hangar doors. All thoughts of boarding the Epimetheus and stealing the sub disappeared. Dying aboard the Benthos was far better than facing the terror circling outside. Terry heard the hydraulic rams activate, forcing water out of the hangar and into holding areas located throughout the Benthos. Long minutes passed as the chamber finished draining. She waited until the panel lights turned green, then exited the control room, inhaling the humidity left behind by the sea. Walking along the damp floor, she inspected the room, verifying the absence of any evidence she had been there. She held her breath, hearing a strange noise. It was a deep scratching sound, coming from outside the hangar door. Terry ran from the chamber, sealing the corridor door shut behind her. Bait. Gulf of Alaska. It was dawn by the time Mac's helicopter touched down on the deck of the William Beebe. Harry Moon greeted them, escorting them to the control room. Jonas saw Dr. Marin and Captain Morgan leaning over a chart of the Gulf of Alaska. Celeste was on the other side of the room, arguing with someone on a ship to shore.
"You guys look like hell," said the captain. "Been there," Mac muttered.
Celeste slammed down the receiver.
"God damn it! The Canadian authorities are holding us responsible for the deaths of the female kayaker and the kid who fell off the ferry."
"We are responsible," Jonas said.
"That's horseshit," Celeste said.
"If a lion escapes from a zoo and kills someone, the zoo's responsible," Mac said.
Celeste rolled her eyes.
"Well, thank you so very much for enlightening me. You'll be happy to know that the Canadian Coast Guard has now decided to handle the situation themselves. They've dispatched a cutter and two helicopters to locate the shark and kill it."
Marin scoffed.
"Fuck the Canadians. By nightfall, the female will have moved into Alaskan waters and out of their jurisdiction."
"Why are we changing course?" Jonas asked. Marin pointed to the map. "From Vancouver Island, there are two distinct routes migrating whales take to the Bering Sea. We now know the Megalodon is following the main route along the Canadian and Alaskan coastlines. I expect the shark to continue heading west until she reaches the Aleutian Islands, at which time she should follow the whale pods north right into the Bering Sea. The William Beebe is now following an alternate route, a shortcut used primarily by gray whales. Our new heading is much quicker, cutting across the Gulf of Alaska, placing us ahead of the shark. This will allow us to cut her off here, at Cape Chiniac, Kodiak Island." Jonas studied the map.
"And once we get ahead of her, how do you plan to locate her, let alone draw her close enough to the ship to hit her with your harpoon?"
"Change of plans," Celeste said. "We are going to drug the monster by using bait."
"What kind of bait?"
"Sea lions," Marin said. "The creature's favorite delicacy. When we get to Kodiak Island, three freshly killed sea lion bulls will be loaded on board. I'm going to surgically implant large dosages of anesthetic into each carcass. We'll hook the bait, attach it to the winch by steel cable, then drag it along the surface until the megalodon takes it. Within 5 minutes of consuming the drugs, the shark will be out cold."
Captain Morgan studied the map.
"When do you estimate the monster will reach Cape Chiniac?"
"If she continues her present speed, maybe 3 or 4 days."
"Then I suggest we go on shifts," Harry said.
Marin nodded in agreement.
"I'll put together a schedule."
Valley Memorial Hospital, Monterey, California. When Sadia Kleffner entered her employer's private room, she was surprised to see him sitting up in bed, a nurse tending to him.
"Maceo, how do you feel?"
"Oh, Sadia, thank God. Kindly inform this nurse that I must leave here immediately."
"Just sit back and relax, Mr. Tanaka. You're not going anywhere until the doctor says."
"But I feel better."
"I'm sure your doctor will be glad to hear that. Now lie back down before I tie you to the bed."
Maceo glared at the nurse, then lay back, giving in to the larger woman. Sadia sat down on the edge of the bed. They finished replacing the lagoon doors yesterday. King Kong himself couldn't get through these. Marcia watched the nurse leave.
What is it, Sadia? I know when you're hiding something.
Sadia broke eye contact.
There's been another death. A young boy.
Marcia shut his eyes, feeling the strain in his chest.
The media's on the warpath. Things are getting